You're listening to The Reason Podcast. I'm Zach Weissmuller. Today I'm speaking with Kevin Matthews of Decriminalize Denver, the group responsible for a recently passed voter initiative that made the possession or use of psilocybin mushrooms the city's lowest law enforcement priority. In other words, decriminalizing magic mushrooms. I spent some time with Kevin and other members of the campaign in the lead up to the vote earlier this month in order to produce video coverage for Reason TV. It was a hell of a ride. I went in blind with no publicly available polling data, but assuming passage of the initiative to be a long shot, given that it's always hard to be the first, and having heard from insiders in the psychedelic science world, which we'll talk more about later, that the decriminalization of a single drug like magic mushrooms actually tends to be even less popular than the blanket decriminalization of all drugs, with voters tending to view the former as societal endorsement of a given drug, while the latter can be more easily interpreted as a harm reduction measure. So I was skeptical. But as I became more acquainted with Denver in the days preceding the vote, becoming vaguely more aware of the city's mixture of progressive politics and libertarian my body, my choice ethos, accompanying a friend who was particularly enthusiastic about the initiative to the Rhino Arts District, where psychedelic street art adorns buildings and an entire alley, and talking with activists like Kevin about the strong psychedelic subculture already present there, my mind began to change. Maybe this could actually win? I went to the election night party, being held in a decommissioned synagogue that had been converted into Invisible City, a trippy event space complete with live psychedelic painting, glowing projections of spinning fractals, and a room of people lying with their eyes closed under strobe lights with headphones on. The party hadn't even really started when the first batch of votes rolled in a little before 7 o'clock, showing the initiative behind by about 9,000 votes or 9 percentage points. The next batch came at about 8:30, and the gap hadn't really closed. By 11:30, things had moved a bit, but not enough in the right direction, with the initiative still trailing by about 5 points. The next morning, the initiative was still down by about 4 points, and some media outlets had called the likely loss. I released my video report, essentially saying, close, but not enough, maybe next time. But Kevin texted me a warning. It's not over yet. There's still a final batch of votes set to come in at 3 p.m. A final batch of votes that's going to move the needle 4 percentage points? Seems unlikely, but okay. He was right. It wasn't over. Denver voted to decriminalize magic mushrooms by a single percentage point, and I had some important revisions to make to my video. So now I want to talk with Kevin some more about how this happened. How'd he win? How will this actually change things in Denver, and what can we learn from what happened there? Kevin Matthews, thank you very much for taking some more time to talk with me.
Zach, it's an absolute pleasure. And I want to say how awesome it is to hear your perspective and your experience with this, because, you know, I've just been in it and I'm still in it 2 weeks later. And it's always such a pleasure to hear from other people who were a part of the process and their thinking around this. So that was awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, well, let's go back to that moment, though, where you found out late afternoon, the day after the election. What were you thinking and feeling when you saw that final dump of votes that put you ahead?
Wow. I was on the phone with my field director for the campaign, and we were running some math and staying positive, knowing that Denver elections was about to drop the final results. And while I was on the phone with him, I received a phone call from another journalist friend here in Denver. And I had a feeling that I was getting this call because elections had just made their announcement. So I hung up with Travis, got on the phone with Connor, and Connor said, you won, Kevin, you won. So I hung up the phone and went and refreshed the elections website. And sure enough, there we were, 50 point, it was like 4-6%
yeah.
Official, unofficial final results. And I burst into tears and started screaming.
Wow.
because, you know, I mean, everything for the last I mean, just the last year and a half had been leading, up to this moment, and what a way to secure a victory here in Denver. It still shocks me in a really good way.
Well, I mean, you mentioned it had been, roughly a year and a half of work. Can you tell me a little bit about how that all started? I mean, this was really, my understanding is pretty much a grassroots campaign, and you came on, I believe, as a graphic designer type consultant, and then eventually became the head of the campaign. So how did that all transpire?
Yeah, that's right. My first position within the committee was our social media graphic design website guy. And so I actually had heard about the campaign, I guess back in, it was January of 2018, and that's when I got involved. Prior to that, another gentleman named Tyler Williams had essentially formed a steering committee and had contacted some attorneys and was just starting to really explore what this could possibly look like in Denver, back in December of 2017. And I just, I latched onto this. I had first heard about the studies that the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS, had been conducting regarding using MDMA as a treatment option for veterans with PTSD. And that was amazing to me. Just being a veteran, knowing that our veterans and other people who suffer from these extreme traumas need other resources, because what we have right now may not be necessarily working for everyone. And then kind of fast forward a few years, as soon as I heard that Denver was exploring having a ballot initiative to decriminalize or otherwise psilocybin mushrooms, I was all over it. And so it's really like really meeting the right person at the right time and having the right conversation. And that's how this ensued for me. I showed a very big interest in this and came with a specific skill set and in terms of spreading awareness and educating people. And I just went right to work. And then it really wasn't until about the end of May of 2018, when my transition to the campaign director was solidified. And it was at that moment where I started to work to bring together, policy professionals in different areas who could actually really help us, because we submitted an initial version of our language in March of 2018, which was rejected by Denver Elections on some technicalities. And then in that language, we were exploring, and it's actually very, very, very well written looking back on it, but that one had included civil penalties for possession. So it essentially defelonized possession, but individuals would still face civil penalties, so fines for possession. And that didn't feel to me like it was the right step. For me, in my head, it was, full decriminalization to the highest degree possible or nothing. And so it was really at that point that we kind of went back to the drawing board. We drafted another version of the language that tried to exempt Denver residents from state law, which you can't do that. and then, so in May is when we really kind of got our stuff together and I started bringing in individuals who would represent the committee as it really exists today and through the life cycle of the campaign.
Then talk a little bit about your personal connection to this, because, and we covered this a little bit in the video, but you suffered from depression and mushrooms helped you is the short version, but perhaps you can fill us in as to how that all worked.
Sure. I was a cadet at the U.S. Military Academy and had devoted my entire life to serving our country as a career military officer. And during my time at West Point, I was diagnosed with major depression and ended up receiving a medical discharge and medical retirement from the U.S. Army. And that, and I do want to say that the Army did the best they could. You know, our nation's military doesn't necessarily have the resources, nor do I really think that it's their responsibility to work with individuals who have mental health issues, which like which I had. And so the choice there was, like, for me, I was given an option where I could return to West Point, or resign my appointment to the Academy and essentially resign my commission and a career in the Army. And my thinking was that, you know, I have these deep personal issues and mental health issues that I'm working on. It would not be responsible for me to be an officer leading men and women into combat, you know, in a war zone. And that was a tough choice, but it was the one that made the most sense to me out of, you know, respecting the other men and women who would choose that military path. So I left West Point, and when I did, it's as if my sense of self crumbled beneath my feet. I didn't have a direction or a purpose in my life. And so I spent really about 3 years kind of getting back on the ground. And in this process, I was getting into self-help, learning about other spiritual modalities, yoga, Zen, Buddhism, and just really kind of like digesting all of this data and information to come back to the core of my own being and like a sense of knowing who I am. And it was this one experience that I had with a group of new friends here in Denver that really opened my eyes, because so we all ate about 2 to 3 grams of mushrooms, psilocybin mushrooms, and just went for a walk through the city. And these are individuals who had experience in this territory. You know, they understood set and setting. They were close friends. I trusted them. And we just let the experience unfold. And in that container, in that experience, I felt this deep sense of belonging, both to these amazing people who were around me, and to myself. And it was the kind of thing where I realized that in so many of the decisions that I've made in my life, they've come from this place of being a victim to my depression. And my experience with mushrooms illuminated that I have a choice, and I can actually make a new choice and not be stuck in this pattern of self-doubt and this pattern of just not really believing in myself. And so it totally crushed my like depression worldview. Like, it was like, this, I don't have to accept this. I can now move forward and make new choices and create new habits and routines and patterns in my life that support me. So it was like that experience, and there were a handful of other experiences really in the past 8 to 10 years or so that reinforced that first one. And so, you know, not needing to necessarily return or keep using mushrooms, my experience with psilocybin enabled me to start to make some new choices for myself that ended up being more healthy.
So psilocybin mushrooms were just recently declared by the FDA as a breakthrough treatment, which means that they are fast-tracked for study specifically for treating depression. So did you know about any of that science at the time that you took them, or did you kind of just stumble into this?
No, I stumbled into it. My experience with mushrooms was even before I started learning about the work that MAPS was doing with MDMA. That designation that you're referring to comes from the FDA, and it's called a breakthrough therapy status. And so, as you said, what that means is that it's going to help fast track the research. And so, yeah, I had no idea about that. But and
so what is it about the experience that you think is so effective for people specifically with depression?
Well, I'd like to say that, you know, if anybody does actually have depression or suffer from some of these other, you know, identified mental health disorders, if they're considering exploring mushrooms as a treatment option, you know, please consult your psychologist or psychiatrist, and find somebody who can stay on the ground and stay sober and be with you through the experience. It's really important for people who are suffering from mental health issues to really create that supportive container and make sure that they have resources available to help talk about the process before and after, and especially after. And so it was, you know, I really hadn't, what it was about the experience for me was that it let me see outside the box that my mind had created for my own life. It allowed me to take some perspective and not necessarily be stuck in this mindset that I'm a depressed person and so I have to act like a depressed person. And I think, you know, the experience varies from time to time. For me, it's, well, I mean, it showed me where I was making some silly decisions, and it showed me where I was like sacrificing my own power to this diagnosis. And although the diagnosis was real, I think a lot of the times, like if somebody's diagnosed with a mental illness, then in many cases, that person might like surrender to the fact that they have this problem, right? And then so they start to, from my own personal experience, I mapped out and created my entire life and how I responded to life from having this problem. And so kind of like at a baseline, I was operating from, I'm a person with depression. And my experience with mushrooms enabled me to say, wait a second, I can choose what my baseline is. Is my baseline from the experience of being sick or mentally ill, or is my baseline from an experience of health and longevity and actually being open to work through my issues and being more accepting and open to life's experiences instead of, I mean, for me personally, I felt isolated and alone and like I wasn't a part of a community. And so it was a shift in perspective that the mushrooms enabled for me, which then created this opportunity to start to make these new choices and start to put myself out there and realize that I have a community of people who I can lean on. Mm. I think that's a big part of this too, is that, you know, in so many ways, having a community of people to lean on, people to talk to, people to cry with, people to laugh with, people to have these incredible experiences with, is so important to healing trauma. You know, we don't have to feel so isolated and alone. And I think it's, again, speaking from personal experience, it's hard for people with depression to take that like first step of vulnerability to ask for help. Right. Unless they're talking to their psychiatrist or their psychologist, because that's kind of the structure that we put in. Like, it's okay to talk about our issues with our doctors, but necessarily not okay to talk about our issues with our friends or our family or the community we have. And so in my experience with mushrooms just reinforced the fact that, hey, there is this amazing group of people here who love you and support you and want to help you move through and heal from the traumas that I've experienced. Mm.
And as far as that community goes, could you give us a little bit of insight into, I guess, the psychedelic community or scene in Denver, and how much of a role did that play in this campaign? And then I guess more broadly, you know, I laid out in my introduction a few of my impressions of Denver, but you know the city far better than I do. So what do you think made this city a particularly good place to pilot mushroom decriminalization?
I think that Denver is the only place in the country where this could have happened in 2019. And it's for a lot of reasons. I mean, first of all, we have, well, I mean, just look at cannabis, right? We have a strong history of drug policy reform. There's a very strong network of cannabis consumers here in Denver. And a lot of those people are using cannabis to actually treat physical and mental health symptoms that they're experiencing. It's not just about recreational use. It's about how do we look at cannabis as a medicine. For example, our governor just signed a bill into law that would allow doctors to prescribe medical cannabis to their patients instead of opiates, right? And so there's a culture of use. There's a culture of experimentation with some of these non-traditional, non-pharmaceutical molecules, compounds, and substances that can be used to actually treat some of these symptoms that we're facing as individuals and as a society. So, you know, as a baseline, because of cannabis and because of the culture that exists with cannabis, that did, I think at the end of the day, really help push us to that 50.65% now is the final tally of just individuals who have experience kind of using these different substances, whether it's cannabis or psilocybin or even ketamine. There is a culture of understanding that there are natural remedies available to people that work in many ways a lot better than the pharmaceutical traditional interventions that are being used to treat people's symptoms, like depression, like anxiety, ADHD, things like that. So, you know, that culture that's here that already existed gave us a really big boost. And then I think also at the same time here in Denver, Denver is a microcosm of the psychedelic community. Even after Prohibition came down in 1970 that made psychedelics a Schedule I substance, Denver was still a hub for that culture that went underground. Even going as far back to to prior to Prohibition, but like the Beatnik generation, Denver was a hub for that. So Denver's always been in many ways on this leading cultural edge of like creating new mindsets and new worldviews. And then at the same time here in Denver, there's a very strong, for lack of a better term, transformational community. I think that you could include, like, if you just imagine like Burning Man culture or kind of like conscious festival culture, and then the art scene and the tech scene, you know, there's all of these different factors that are coming together to make Denver this incredible nexus of ideas and worldviews that, whenever I talk to people who visit Denver, they always say how nice the people here are. And we are, you know, maybe it's because we're the Mile High City and there's something in the air. I don't know what it is, but it seems like that people in Denver, it's a little bit of a slower pace, although we're growing and we're growing quickly and we have our issues with that. But it's like, just growing up here and understanding the community and kind of what Denver's all about. It's we're kind, we're mostly compassionate. We have our problems like every major metropolitan area, but it's like people come here for 300 days of sunshine, epic winter sports, and this incredible melting pot of worldviews where, you know, we can actually have the space to share these ideas.
I want to dig down a little bit into the details of the law itself, just so people have a clear understanding of what it is and isn't. It modifies the municipal code to make the personal use and possession of psilocybin mushrooms by persons 21 years of age and older the city's low and lowest law enforcement priority. That's the first part of the law. And so this is decriminalization, not legalization of commercial sales. So could you just differentiate the two for us a little bit more and explain why it is you went for decriminalization?
Yes. So the biggest difference between decriminalization and the legalization is that legalization requires some kind of regulated oversight. And so when you get into that, you're talking about licensing, you're talking about distribution, and everything that comes along with that. So imagine recreational cannabis, or even just like imagine how alcohol is regulated. That's what legalization would imply in this case. Whereas with decriminalization, we're specifically making sure that nobody faces these severe criminal penalties for possession or use. Mm-hmm. And it just makes it, you know, as you mentioned, and in our language, the lowest enforcement priority for Denver police. So that's the biggest distinction. And
so why did you go that route?
So we went that route because legalization, we're not ready for it yet. We have so much more work to do now in terms of educating the population, both in Denver, statewide, and really nationwide. A lot of the pushback that we got from people who were opposed to this was that, most of those individuals simply weren't educated about psilocybin. They were putting psilocybin in the same box as something like heroin or other opiates or methamphetamines or cocaine, right? And so a Schedule I substance, the definition of a Schedule I is that it has no medical value and a high risk of abuse. And that's the exact opposite of psilocybin. Mm-hmm. Psilocybin is non-addictive, and at least according to the last 20 years or so and more of modern clinical research, psilocybin does in fact have a ton of medical benefits. And so we have our work to do, taking this slow, taking this one step at a time, and I think education is going to win the day at the end of the day, and really, really help determine how this movement moves forward, both here in Colorado and across the entire country. We have work to do in terms of making sure that people understand, and really just like change their minds about mushrooms.
I mean, Colorado was one of the first two states to legalize recreational cannabis sales. So it's now clearly on the frontier of drug policy with this latest move. But when I spoke with your political coordinator in producing the video, her name is Cindy Sovine, she was very involved with cannabis policy. But she told me that she was explicitly rejecting the cannabis model, which everywhere that it happened went from medical first and then recreational sales. And she said this was actually not modeled on that at all, but on sanctuary city laws, which was pretty interesting. Could you explain that connection a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. So Denver is considered a sanctuary city for immigration policy. Right. Our Denver does not necessarily cooperate with state or federal authorities when it comes to immigrants and immigration. We're an open city, and, you know, Denver's government allows people to seek sanctuary here in Denver. And so in the Denver code, I think it's Article 8 in the Denver Revised Municipal Code, Article 8 is our sanctuary city language. And then right beneath that is Article 9, which is our psilocybin decrim language. And so we're not working right now to create any kind of commerce or for-profit model industry behind psilocybin. Psilocybin is part of the public domain. And so it's my belief and the belief of our committee and our team and our volunteers that it's important that we keep this process as open source as possible. We keep it as accessible as possible. And at the end of the day, decriminalizing it first ensures that and creates precedent for allowing individuals to possess, use, and propagate or cultivate mushrooms because it is a naturally occurring substance. And so that's our first step here was to liberate individuals having the ability to use mushrooms without facing these severe criminal penalties.
Yeah, it's just an interesting kind of flip on its head because the first path is you kind of top down create this legal framework and you're almost saying we need to allow this culture to come out a little bit more organically and then we will have a better idea of what the proper legal framework on top of that is. Is that about right?
So to reiterate, it's important that nobody faces these severe penalties for possession and use. And that's where we start. And then from there, you know, one thing I'm very excited about is that with our movement here in Denver, there's the potential for more research and for gathering more data. And keep in mind that organizations like MAPS and it's actually really like really Johns Hopkins University and this other group called the Hefter Foundation, which is a group of researchers and clinicians. You know, this work at the federal level to research mm-hmm. a Schedule I costs millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars to do. Now that we've decriminalized here in Denver, we have an opportunity to explore more research potentially without the extreme costs associated with that research. And so it's very important for us to decriminalize. And, you know, we're very excited about the work in California as well, because California has a statewide decrim initiative. And just seeing how we can move forward here in a way that creates equity in terms of access and in terms of people's choice to use this medicine.
Yeah. And I mean, as far as the medicalization route goes, you mentioned organizations like MAPS, which have spent decades opening paths of legitimate scientific research and now seem to be probably less than a couple of years away of seeing MDMA approved by the FDA for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. So there's a lot mm-hmm. of money that's flowing into the research of psychedelics now, both here and overseas in the UK. Have you been in contact with the research community much post-decriminalization? And if so, what has the reaction been like from that side?
I have, and it seems to be a little bit of a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. A lot of researchers, from what I understand, agree that no person should go to jail for using mm-hmm. mushrooms. And their valid concern is that we may have a repeat of the 60s here. And my argument to that, and what I mean is that in the 60s, there was rampant cultural use. And to echo Michael Pollan's words, you know, we had a whole generation of young people being having this rite of passage a rite of passage into territories of the mind that the older generations at that time had no idea about. And so, of course, it was a threat, or it was construed as a threat, where you have these young generations having these deeply profound experiences and then becoming anti-war protesters or things like that. And so that was, you know, it makes sense to me that back then it was a threat to the establishment mm-hmm. Because the establishment had no idea what these people were doing. And at the same time, we didn't necessarily have a rooted foundation and cultural context for using psychedelics, including psilocybin and LSD, right? And so in the 60s, it was kind of a free-for-all, and we didn't have people with a lot of experience who could help guide those individuals who were choosing to use these other psychedelics. Fast forward almost 50 years, now we do have a very strong underground culture of use. We have a very strong foundation for, you know, for what responsible use looks like. We have elders, we have, what I mean by that is researchers and clinicians and policy experts and individuals who've dedicated their entire life to this, you know, 20, 30 years or more, who can actually help advise and create the backbone of this cultural use. And so, in terms of what just happened in Denver, that now that we've done this bottom-up grassroots campaign to decriminalize psilocybin, it's a clear signal to the rest of the country that Americans are ready to start talking about psilocybin mushrooms more. It's a clear signal that there is a culture of use, you know, of which Denver is a microcosm. And I can tell you that I've been in contact with people from coast to coast. I mean, I mentioned California. Let's go as far out as Anchorage. From Anchorage, Alaska, to Washington, D.C., there are teams of people who want to do their own ballot initiatives and get advice on the process and you know, become aligned with our messaging for how we were successful out here. So, you know, we've opened up a new front in the psychedelic renaissance, and it's, you know, this is just me. I think that sometimes the researchers and the clinicians and those, with all due respect, you know, those individuals sometimes forget that there is an underground, and that I would argue a majority of people who choose to use psilocybin understand that there are risk factors, and they understand that there's a responsible way to use mushrooms. Just like alcohol and tobacco comes with a warning label, you know, so do mushrooms as well. And there's a responsible way to use them.
Yeah, well, the path that I've seen that the medical side lay out is something like this. There would be clinical psychiatrist with special training, then maybe, you know, expanded to psychologists and counselors with some special training. You know, licensed individuals would be overseeing the administration of these psychedelics to patients. And then maybe down the road, we'd see a loosening up of the licensing, and it'll be almost like we have like licensed shamans out of studios helping people access these. Mm-hmm. That's one vision, but how does that jive or not jive with how you see things playing out in the next 10 or 15 years?
Well, I think both are extremely important. You know, the model we're working with here with decriminalizing is a necessary part of the entire picture. Same with the researchers. A lot of people, if they choose that they want to utilize mushrooms, they may feel more comfortable going into a doctor's office in a clinical setting with trained professionals and medical practitioners on call and ready to be there for them. And that's totally fine. I think it's necessary. On the other hand, going back to that, there's this fairly established underground network, mm-hmm, where we have people who, you know, not doctors per se, but guides, individuals who have many years of experience holding space or creating an environment where individuals can utilize mushrooms in a safe manner. You know, that exists. And when we start talking about medical frameworks or regulated frameworks, it just starts to get expensive. You know, and consider that, and I would argue that many of the individuals who could benefit the most from mushrooms, if we're talking about things like addiction, anxiety, and depression, you know, a lot of those individuals are in more marginalized communities and communities of color. And those individuals may not necessarily be able to afford a medical session with psilocybin. Because when we get into the medical part of it, we're talking about licensing, we're talking about insurance, we're talking about those overhead costs. And a lot of the time, at least how I understand it, a lot of those costs get pushed to the patient, and the patient's responsible for those costs. Mm-hmm. Right. And that, you know, that makes it challenging for the individuals who need this to actually be able to have access to it, which is why, you know, decriminalizing creates equity of access and equity of choice. And then, you know, if we can get this underground community plugged in a way where there are resources, people have access to information where they can find the right people to help support them through an experience without necessarily breaking their bank, is a good model. And I think both can work.
So it
together.
It sounds like what you would like to see in Denver is for this community that already exists to be able to come out of the shadows a little bit. And I want to get a sense of how much this decriminalization initiative does to actually advance that. I've read some reports from local Denver media that the police and DA are trying to downplay the reach of this a bit and say it's more like advice to law enforcement on their priorities rather than actual decriminalization. But there is a part of the initiative that reads pretty differently to me. There's part that says that it would prohibit the city from spending resources to impose criminal penalties for the personal use and personal possession of psilocybin mushrooms by persons 21 years of age or older. So mm-hmm. that sounds pretty straightforward, but how binding is this law, is this, you know, on law enforcement?
Well, I'll put this in perspective. I just found out last week that there was an individual who came to one of our post-election events who was in court that day for possessing mushrooms, and the judge threw it out because the judge was like, didn't we just decriminalize this in Denver?
Wow.
This is gone. And that's a huge, that's like a 180
yeah.
from what happened with cannabis in 2005 and 2007. You know, there was a fight. And I think that like that is such a positive thing to know that there was a Denver judge who said, we're not going to charge you for this because we just decriminalized it. And so, you know, right now we're working in the background with the DA's office and the Justice Department to make sure that this gets implemented as it stands. And, you know, we're not really, as a committee, we're not going to, well, we want to make sure the language gets implemented as it was voted on by the people. And so really no changes to this. I know that there are some questions that the DA's office has, but from what I understand, I mean, both candidates for mayor, because we're in a pretty tight runoff election right now for our city's government here in Denver. Both candidates have stated that they will support the will of the people here.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, you know, the votes for legalizing or decriminalizing mushrooms beat out either of those candidates, so makes some sense.
Mushrooms got more vote for mayor, more vote than for mayor. Yeah. Like it's incredible. You know, this was a historic election in Denver for a lot of reasons. And I'll share this because this is public knowledge. You know, as a campaign, we spent we raised and spent just over $46,000. And we were able to get over 90,000 votes in favor, which comes out to about 50 cents per vote, a little bit less, which is, or I guess a little bit more, which is unheard of. Mm-hmm. And so in my mind, that just really reinforces the fact that people want this. Individuals will come out for this and support it, and work to create this legislative change across the country. We can do this from the bottom up. We don't necessarily have to wait for the federal government to give their grand approval, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, we have a lot of responsibility. It's really on us to demonstrate that a group of citizens can come together and create this kind of social change in a manner that is bringing all the parties to the table, that acknowledges and respects everyone who's involved, and shows that there are, you know, that people respect the safety precautions.
Along those lines, the final component of the law is supposed to establish an assessment panel to see what are the results of the decriminalization. So why did you make that part of the initiative, and what kind of data are you hoping to collect?
Yeah, so that's a very important part to this, because it keeps the conversation going at the city level, right? So this panel will be comprised of members of city council, two city council representatives, one from the DA's office, one from the Denver City Attorney's office, one Denver Police Department representative, one Sheriff's Department representative, one harm reduction advocate, one criminal defense attorney, one representative from the Sheriff's Department, one certified therapist, and also two members of the proponent committee, our committee for decriminalizing. And so, you know, like I've said all along, that we want to establish a good relationship with the city of Denver. We want to work with city officials, because if we're considering that, you know, Denver is no exception to this, we have a national mental health and opiate crisis, right? Let's explore other alternatives. Let's start to gather more data. And so part of our objectives for the rest of this year is to actually push up the formation of that panel. According to our language, the mayor's office has until December 31st, 2019 to appoint the members of that panel. I think it would be much more prudent to have that happen sooner rather than later. And then, so the purpose of the panel is to, this will be the first of its kind in the entire country, where we have city government officials and proponents of a psilocybin decriminalization measure meeting multiple times per year to explore the impact and the effects of decriminalizing a substance in a major metropolitan area. And so with that, we can start to gather more arrest data, and then also hopefully explore what other potential options may be, you know, if we're looking at having a research site or something of that matter. So a lot of those details need to get hashed out, but in terms of like these next steps, getting that panel implemented as soon as possible is a priority.
Hmm. And in terms of arrest data, I mean, one of the, I guess it's a criticism you hear, is that mushrooms aren't a particularly high priority they weren't a high priority before the initiative. The DA released some numbers saying that of the over 9,000 drug cases that were filed between 2016 and 2019, only 11 involved psilocybin, and only 3 of those were for possession or intent to manufacture or distribute. So how big an impact do you really expect this to have from a harm reduction perspective, you know, either here in Denver or other places where it might happen?
Yeah, I guess it depends on how you're defining or measuring impact. Yeah. You know, now we have a huge opportunity to create more educational experiences for people and to start to change public perception around the potential benefits of mushrooms. Right. And then I'd be 11 out of 9,500, right? That's a very, 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 very small number. I think in the city of Denver, it was 50 arrests per year, and a handful of those were eventually prosecuted. So, you know, this initiative in many ways was to create a precedent and protect individuals in the city who are already using mushrooms. And to alleviate the fear associated with needing to constantly look over their shoulder during the experience. Like that's a pretty big deal. You know, if somebody chooses to use mushrooms and kind of always having it in the back of your head, like, man, I can go to jail for this right now. You know, this is, you know, this, that doesn't, like, removing that barrier or removing that fear will help create better, I think, create better experiences for people where they can actually have more trust and more faith in it. And then at the same time, like, you know, although these numbers are small, imagine if a person who was arrested and criminalized for mushrooms was your friend, your brother, your sister, your dad, your son, your daughter. You know, these are nonviolent, victimless, quote unquote, crimes. And now that person, that one person, is facing these extreme severe penalties for possessing a mushroom. So one arrest is too many for this. What's better here is, and now that, you know, I think we're enabling this, is creating a dialogue, having a conversation. Let's start to shift the Overton window on people's perceptions of the substances that we use as a society and create more educational opportunities around this. Let's start to create a more compassionate model versus a criminalization model. I mean, in many ways, so many of our nation's prisons also double as mental health facilities, right? But those people in prison aren't getting the help they need because they're in prison. They're not in a rehab facility. You know, so, you know, these drug policies, like, nationwide, we know they don't work. We know they're probably creating more problems and creating more trauma in our culture and in our society than is necessary. And so if we can start to, again, create a conversation on how we look at these issues, it's pretty amazing. I mean, psilocybin mushrooms, you know, they've been clinically demonstrated to help individuals with alcoholism and addiction to tobacco. There are also association studies, which is, it's correlation, it's not causation still, which begs more research, that using mushrooms can reduce dependence on opioids. And reduce opioid use. Like mushrooms are a really good first step here in terms of the broader drug policy conversation. Mm.
So you're framing this as the beginning of a broader conversation about drug decriminalization writ large, about the value of psychedelics, and the beginning of really a movement towards decriminalizing psychedelics around the country, which we're starting to see that movement. And Oregon, for instance, is proposing a statewide decriminalization that, from my understanding, looks like it will follow more of the medical model. And then you mentioned California, where I am. And it's my understanding some of the California folks were actually at the election party. So what kind of conversations and advice do you have for them, or have you been sharing with them?
Yeah, I mean, I've been on the phone with California's chief petitioners no less than four times this week. Right. So we're, you know, this is a collaborative movement. I mean, Denver, we have the honor and the privilege and the responsibility of being the first domino here. And so the whole country, perhaps even the whole world, is watching how this is implemented and how our volunteers and supporters actually move forward. Because, like, winning an election is like the very first step, right? Now we have so much more work to do. You know, in terms of these other states, as you mentioned, Oregon, they're looking at a services model. So they're really actually, they're defelonizing and not decriminalizing, but they're defelonizing personal possession and also creating cultivation centers and treatment centers.
And by defelonizing, you mean it'll just be like a traffic ticket, basically.
It'll no longer be exactly. It won't be a felony. Depending on a person's criminal record, it won't be a felony, but there's still some sort of a fine attached to it, attached to possession. And then from what I understand in California, they are doing a statewide decriminalization initiative, which also, If you read their language, it includes transportation and includes that kind of a model too. Like, I think a little bit more relaxed penalties on people sharing or distributing. Still no regulatory model, no you know, there's no no regulated model in California.
I mean, is there anything that you would advise any of these campaigns based on what you went through in Denver, do's and don'ts?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is being upfront about the risks, because there are risks. Talk about the risks. Be transparent. You know, the risks are minimal, and they can especially be minimized with proper education. Psilocybin is not for everyone. And for your listeners, you know, for those who are considering using this, please don't. If you have a history or a family history or genetic predisposition to things like bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, not a good idea to use mushrooms. They're not for everybody. I would say that creating messaging and talking with individuals about responsible use is very important. This isn't like a free for all. Let's just all go get stoned or go for a trip and have fun. Like, these are very serious compounds and very serious molecules, and they've been used for thousands of years by other human cultures with great reverence and respect. And at the same time, promoting, I mean, this is a little bit hard when you get into structural organization for things like a political campaign or a ballot initiative campaign. Keeping it as well, I'll say it this way, kind of my philosophy throughout the campaign, and I definitely made some mistakes, is really like leader. Everybody here can make an impact. And especially here in Denver, this came down to 2,000 votes. So every single little thing that one person did to spread awareness about this made a huge difference and enabled us to exceed. And so everybody is an influencer. Keep it as open source as possible, allow individuals to, take on a role and do a really good job at that role. Talk about the risks, be upfront about that, especially when we're speaking to individuals who are still stuck in the prohibition era mindset. And then I would say, you know, at least here in Denver, and as I mentioned, we're working with these other individuals on a collaborative level, like keep the lines of communication and conversation open and make sure that you're including the researchers and the clinicians and the people who've been doing this work for 30 years in the conversation. I think in many ways, we were blessed to have one of these researchers come in and help advise our campaign in the background, and that really enabled us to create messaging with integrity, especially representing the research, and link up the boots on the ground, these grassroots efforts, with the brains in the lab, the people who are doing the research, because this is all about conversation, and we're all in the same movement together now, especially that, you know, we've been successful in Denver.
So a lot of that boils down to being honest and transparent and empirical, scientific about all this. And that kind of brings me to my last question that I just want you to take a broad view of this as this movement, as it moves forward. Like, imagine that psychedelics do get reintroduced into our society. We've mentioned kind of things that went wrong in the 60s that provoked a backlash. So what would you like to see play out differently this time? And if psychedelics can be reintroduced more responsibly, I guess, what kind of effects might you predict on a societal level?
You know, Zach, we need better rites of passage in our culture. I think that in many ways, I mean, gosh, speaking from personal experience, it seems like alcohol and law enforcement contact is like a typical rite of passage for an American teenager, which is tragic. In many ways, it's tragic, and I don't want to get too far out in the weeds here, but I think we have a real opportunity to really affect extremely positive, beneficial cultural change by accepting things like psilocybin as another tool, as a medicine that individuals can use with guidance and with support to be better humans. A community starts with, like, it really starts with one person, and how that person, it's like, if I can get healthy and I can feel good about myself, then I have more energy and more conviction and more resources available to connect with other people and share ideas and share our passions. And it just kind of, it mushrooms out from there, right? Like, let's work to create a society that can work for everyone. And I, like, that's, I think, is what's possible here. We're in this very critical time right now as a country. If we're looking at, social issues, we're also looking at, like, technology and just how rapidly things are changing. The more that we can come together and, like, get over our differences and establish positive lines of communication and really accept each other for who we are and support each other in our experience of life, because we're at the end of the day all in this together. I think we can, 30 years from now, it may be a lot different and a lot better living here.
Well, that's a hopeful, positive note of unity to end on. And I want to congratulate you again on your victory. And thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me.
It's my pleasure, Zach. I look forward to it again.